Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World.
Hello and welcome to this Tilburg Foundation webinar on Iran and Israel. What next? Roughly 6 weeks ago, the two Middle East powers whom everyone feared might someday go to war actually went to war. After 12 days of fighting, mostly deadly exchanges of missiles, drones, and air power, Iran and Israel agreed to a ceasefire on June 24th. But peace is an elusive concept in the Middle East, even more so these days. Will the ceasefire continue to hold? If it does, what are the likely consequences? If it doesn't, who would break it? Western pundits briefly speculated about regime change in Iran, despite the obvious surge of national pride on the streets of Tehran and elsewhere throughout the country. Similarly, some analysts immediately concluded that Prime Minister Netanyahu, having slayed or at least wounded all the dragons in sight, would finally be forced from office. Although he obviously has more political lives than that proverbial cat with only nine. And what of the ordinary people, Iranians, Israelis, Palestinians, who must be beyond exhausted by seemingly endless death and destruction and fear of yet more? Indeed, I hope today's conversation will mostly be about people and politics and not about geopolitics, but we'll see where it goes. To that end, I've invited three people who are deeply knowledgeable about the situation. Each of them bring a unique perspective. Francesca Bori is an Italian journalist who has spent much of the last decade and more, I think, at this point, living now in Jenin and reporting from the West Bank, from Israel, from Syria, from other places. Ambassador Hussein Mousavian, a former senior Iranian diplomat who now teaches at Princeton University, and Abraham Silver, a lecturer at the Hebrew University on the architecture of Jerusalem. Now let me start from 50,000 feet. What has this war done to Iranians, to Israelis, to Palestinians? What are the realities on the ground as we sit here a couple weeks after the war has at least paused? Hussein, to start?
The Israeli-U.S. attack on Iran was really shocking for the officials and the people of Iran. Frankly speaking, they didn't expect it. Nevertheless, since the issue or the pretext was about the nuclear, first of all, I want to list some of the consequences on the nuclear issue. First is about NPT, Non-Proliferation Treaty. Since revolution 1980, there was two school of thought in Iran, one pro-Iran member of NPT and one against. They have been challenging each other for decades. But now I think there is more consensus among all politicians and even the people of Iran that NPT does not serve the national interest of Iran. And regardless of how far you cooperate with Iran, with the IAEA or implement your commitments within NPT, they will use NPT as an instrument to impose sanctions and pressures. Because these days or recent years, the issue has been about enrichment. But we all remember after revolution 1980, 1979, for 15 years, when Iran did not have enrichment, Iran did not have heavy water, Iran did not have any ambitious nuclear project, the U.S.-Israeli position was the same. Iranian nuclear program is a threat to international peace and security, and since 1991, even the time Iran did not have enrichment, Prime Minister Netanyahu has been each year repeating that Iran is going to get nuclear bomb within a year. And that's why I think there is now more consensus that countries like Israel, like India, like Pakistan, which they have nuclear bomb and they have not accepted NPT, they are right, and NPT really does not help Iran. This is number one. Of course, there would not be immediate reaction from the politicians. They would be patient to see what would be the final outcome of the negotiations. But nevertheless, reformists, the moderates now, they are almost convinced that the issue is not about NPT. The second consequence is about Iran and the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency. Again, we have had the two school of thought during the last 40, 45 years, but now there is more consensus even within moderates and reformists that the IAEA is just a political tool, spy tool for the West, for the US, for Israel to put pressures and sanctions and manufacture documents against Iran. And especially the time IAEA passed, adopted the last resolution on June 12, it was exactly the same time when Israelis, they were loading their bombs to attack Iran. And this coincidence, this timing has been discussed a lot in Iranian media between the people, even officials, that the IAEA passed exactly the time when, before the time, Israelis and Americans, they have coordinated and prepared attacking on Iran. The third negative consequences, I would say, is about weapons of mass destruction. Again, we have had for 40 years the same two school of thought, one pro-Iran being member of all weapons of mass destruction, and the other opposing. But these days, there is at least a big doubt whether really Iran continue to be a member of weapons of mass destruction conventions would serve Iran national interest or not. Because although there is always question about Iranian nuclear ambiguities or technical issues, Iran has been member of chemical weapon conventions, biological weapon conventions, fully committed, fully complied, no claim. But Iran has been deprived from peaceful chemical technology, peaceful biological technology for decades. Therefore, in every conventions, there are rights versus commitments. And for Iran, is only commitments, no rights, whether this is nuclear or chemical or biological.
Hussein, let me interrupt and bring in Abraham and how things post-war look in Israel.
First of all, Alan, thank you very much for inviting me to this platform, and Francesca and Hussein. It's nice to meet you. Here in Israel, we saw the Iranian threat as existential. We saw it on two different levels of existential. One, which is Hussein is talking about, on that level of nuclear. And the other one was on ballistic missiles. And that fear that was hanging over us, we, to a certain extent, in the aftermath of the war, feel a little bit alleviated from that fear. Not, I don't want to overstate that. It's not as if those fears have gone away, but alleviated from an immediate threat of that. And so I think for Israelis in general, in the last few weeks post the end of the ceasefire or the end of the active war, there's been a sense of relief here. And I think that that's kind of where we're at right now. How is everything going to play moving forward is obviously the conversation. But for the moment there in Israel, there's a sense of relief over the existential Iranian threat being at least diverted for the moment.
Francesca, you're reporting from various places in the region. How do you think about, what are you hearing from Israelis, from Palestinians, from a journalist point of view, post-war?
Palestinians are where they've been since October 7th or so. In Gaza, Palestinians are getting killed. And in the West Bank, Palestinians are living, are trying to leave as much as possible. forced out by settler attacks, IDF raids, and the economic crisis by poverty. And there is no international law. There is no international action. There is no Palestinian leadership. And there's no Israeli awareness of what's really happening in Gaza. That there's denial, basically. And there is just Netanyahu, Netanyahu and Netanyahu and Netanyahu. And there are no Palestinians except, you know, underground.
Hossein, you started by talking about the diplomatic situation and the systematic, from your point of view, discovery that the various conventions have been, as you said, working against Iran, obligations, not rights. We are where we are, though. We've had this war. There was a lot of destruction. Either in political terms or from the point of view of Iranian citizens, what do you expect? What happens next?
The Iranian domestic situation economically, Alan, is very bad. It is not just because of the recent war. Of course, this has been deteriorated, but it is for at least two decades, especially after the presidency of Ahmadinejad has become worse and worse. Therefore, the main Iranian complaint, the Iranian nation, is about the economic situation, the main and the most important issue. Nevertheless, the war impacted Iranian nation a little bit different what Bibi Netanyahu and even Americans and Westerners, they expected. They were thinking if there would be attack on Iran, the people would support the attack, they would go for regime change, they would uprising. And so it was completely vice versa, because the nation felt the issue really is about Iran, not about the Islamic Republic. And they all get united. They got united to resist the Israeli-American strike on Iran. This is this was perhaps for the first time in the last 20, 30 years, we had almost a united nation. And the nation was very united to resist the aggression of Iran. The second is about disappointment between the people about the usefulness of negotiating with the U.S. because they were during negotiating, first of all, they negotiated JCPOA, Iran accepted, UN passed resolution, Iran was in full compliance, and the U.S. withdrew. Second, again, in the second Trump of presidency term of Trump, Iran accepted to negotiate. Actually, there was agreement between Witkoff and Arabchi on the most important principles of the deal. But because of Israeli pressure, we had a setback. And then exactly 2 days before the sixth round of negotiations agreed between Witkoff and Arabchi, Israel attacked Iran. And exactly on the same day, Iran and European ministers, they were negotiating, the U.S. attacked Iran. Therefore, now many people, I would not say completely, but a big portion of the nation, they really believe this round of negotiations at least has been a trap to engage Iran in a negotiation and prepare attacking Iran. Therefore, I would say more than ever, there is disappointment between the Iranian nation and even officials that there is no hope for negotiating with U.S., Europe, the West in order to have a fair deal, especially when President Trump said Iran should negotiate and with unconditional surrender. This wording was, extremely negative. It had extremely negative impact on Iranian nation. A U.S. president asking Iran to negotiate and unconditional surrender. Otherwise, you would be attacked. Therefore, this also has been a very bad consequences because always, at least reformists and moderates, they have been supporting negotiating with the U.S. Even they have been supporting the Israeli-Iranian conflict should be ended. There is no need to continue hostilities with Israel. But now we have negative consequences.
Abraham, I read something you wrote, and I'd like you to tell the story, not me, because it goes to this unity point. You wrote about that first night of the attack on the Iranian missiles coming into Israel, that you were sitting in a shelter with your kids, and you made the comparison to the first time when they were in first grade and now they're graduating from high school. Can you just repeat the anecdote?
Yeah, I think that it moves towards a greater understanding in terms of the way Israel has seen this entire conflict, this recent conflict, and that is that obviously the conflict is the Gaza conflict with all of the issues of the Gaza conflict. But as time progressed through the Gaza conflict, it became clear that there was Hezbollah as well, and Hezbollah was this threat on the other side of the country. And then it became clear as that developed that behind Hezbollah and Hamas was actually Iran, that the real threat was Iran. And without going through the entire, you know, year and a half of different stages of the war, it became clear to Israelis that the war was never going to really be resolved until the existential threat from Iran had been taken care of. And that's what I was writing about, which is that, hey, wait a minute, we started sitting in bomb shelters as Israelis when the girls were in first grade, 2014, if I remember right. And now we were sitting in bomb shelters again with the Iran conflict, and maybe this would be the last time. Maybe the world could change because of this, and we wouldn't be going to bomb shelters anymore. And maybe when they get married, we won't be running to bomb shelters. So I think that for Israelis, there was this real strong understanding that we were peeling away the onion, and eventually we needed to get to the core, which was the existential threat of Iran. And once again, as I said, in the 12-day war, Israelis feel that we at least have deflected that existential threat for the moment. The question really that we should be putting on the table is, what now, moving forward, how does that work? But for the moment, we feel a little bit relieved from that. It was always going to be about Iran. And I will say this emotionally, which is that in October, when the events happened that October, that there was a tit-for-tat between Iran and Israel, the public, not the military, but the public was like, wait, why did we stop? We need to take care of this existential threat. Why do we stop? We now understand that the military was planning what Hussein kind of very much just laid out, you know, what happened in June. But for the public was a little frustrated that we stopped in spite of being exhausted about war, in spite of being in the bomb shelters. The public had this feeling of there's only one way forward here, and that is to directly encounter Iran. And again, the military obviously was figuring that out itself, but we, to a certain extent, not relating to Gaza and Hamas and the Palestinians, which of course is the front and center thing, obviously, but in terms of Iran, feeling like we did deflect that existential concept, that existential threat.
Sir Abraham asked, what next? Francesca, what next?
Without Iran, you know, basically Iran made October 7th possible, you know, because it funded Hamas, it founded Islamic Jihad. And then now you have, you know, this analysis, you know, what's happening between Israel and Iran, the analysis, you know, of Hussein and the word Palestinians are not even mentioned, and rightly so, because they are out of the equation, you know, they don't matter. So, of course, you know, you can have, you know, the full analysis without even, you know, mentioning Gaza or Palestinians. And the point is, you know, Palestinians, of course, you know, never counted on Iran for their freedom, because, you know, we all know that Iran has a special plays a special role, you know, in the Middle East. It's a special country because it's one of the three non-Arab countries, you know, so it's a little bit different from others. And for example, in the past, it's been closer to Israel than, I don't know, to Iraq under Saddam Hussein, of course, you know. And the point is, maybe, you know, rightly after October 7th, perhaps, you know, Palestinians were waiting in the least, you know, waiting to see what Hezbollah could do, or, you know, not Iran, but at least Hezbollah. And then when there was, I remember I was in Nablus when there was beginning of November 2023, the famous speech of Nasrallah, where basically Nasrallah said, I'm not going to do anything, I'm not going to join, really, you know, the war. Palestinians realized, you know, that they were basically alone, just a tool, you know, for Arab countries, and especially a tool for Iran, you know. And so what's next? Nothing that is related to Palestinians. What's next is the end game, as, you know, both our, of course, Israeli friend and, you know, Iranian friend knows very well, both Avram and Hossein. The end game is about Iran, you know. So Netanyahu wants, and actually I would say the majority of Israelis agree with Netanyahu, Israel wants a regime change in Iran, and of course Iran is trying, you know, to resist. Even if I guess there is a difference between this government in Iran and the society, which seems to be not really behind the government, behind the Ayatollah, we will see what happens. But what's next? Nothing that has to do with Palestinians, you know, nothing. So if Hamas, you know, if the aim of October 7 was, you know, to have Palestinians back again, you know, in the map, in the media, in the world agenda, nothing. Palestinians totally disappeared physically and politically. So what's next? What's next? Nothing that has to do with Palestinians.
What do war lessons from Gaza, rethinking education, peace in Ukraine, and visionary leadership have in common? They are all themes from recent episodes of this podcast. Check out more episodes on TelbergFoundation.org or on a platform of your choice.
Hossein, what's next for Iran? You talked about some of the lessons that the elite have learned, that the government has learned, some of the lessons that people have learned. There certainly has been a visible coming together. You talked about unity. What does the leadership do with that unity going forward? Because it is a change.
It depends, Alan. I think there is really a need for major changes in Iranian government's policy on domestic issues and foreign relations, regional issues, even relation with the West, whether the establishment, the leadership would decide for such a major decisions or not, I really don't know, but I don't believe small steps would help. And I have been saying for years, at least for 5-6 years, that the Iranian leadership needs to take a very brave and great major decisions on not only foreign policy, not only in relation with the US or the West or the region, but a domestic situation, not only economic situation, on other issues, cultural, social issues. I really don't know whether they would use this momentum to make such a decisions or not. If not, I don't believe there would be any breakthrough in Iranian domestic situation. Nevertheless, if there is a success in negotiating with the U.S., if there would be a solution on the nuclear, there would be a chance for Iran and the U.S. to negotiate on the regional issues. And I think the U.S. is in position to break an end to Iranian-Israeli hostilities, which I have been calling and writing and saying for several years. Otherwise, everything would go in bad direction.
So I'll say what's next also for us, which I think, first of all, I think Francesca is spot on. One of the tragedies of the fact that eventually became the Iran war was sidelining the Palestinians and making them voiceless again. And that is just a horrible position for the Middle East to be in. And that is a little bit of where we're at. So just straight up, first of all, That's part of the equation right now. In terms of the Israelis, domestically and then foreign policy, or more military, I think the war did something which I know that Israel sometimes has the image of just powerful Israel, but Israel, in its own understanding of self, has often been responsive as opposed to responding to things that were happening rather than taking charge of things that were happening. And I think that this should be a fear for everyone, that Israel has drawn a conclusion, I think for the first time in its existence, that the way forward is to just be powerfully offensive, meaning anyone blinks in the wrong direction, then the Israelis are going to encounter them. And I think you saw that in southern Syria in a way that I think that before October 7th and before June 12th, Israel would never have done. And I think what's next in the Middle East is to work, to be concerned about Israel in terms of what Hussein just said is really great, which is that there needs to be a negotiated settlement and quickly, because the Israelis to a certain extent are unleashed. And and I think that could be dangerous for the Middle East. In terms of domestically for Israel, if you noticed what had happened was that Netanyahu was so proud of himself in terms of the Iran war. They were talking within the 24 hours after the ceasefire that they would go to snap elections, because after all, now he would win this major victory. And then the poll came out 2 days later and the polls hadn't moved. Nobody was interested. Nobody thought that because he won, the people that support him, support him. The people that are against him are against him. He cannot get a majority in the next election. And none of the polls moved. And the polls haven't moved since then either. So we are in that same stalemate. He didn't convince anybody. Just because we went to war with Iran didn't make him the great hero. In the people that support him, he was already that. And the people that despise him, which is a majority of the country, he was never going to be that. So domestically in Israel, we are still rifted and divided. And nothing has happened to change that.
And the danger, to follow up on that question immediately, is that if that's the case, then isn't that a formula for the government to do more of the same?
The answer is not exactly, which is that we're going to need to have new elections soon, meaning we're moving towards new elections, the date of new elections. The government, when that happens, will be in election mode. If no one gets a majority, the government's caretaker. The government is limited what it could do legally as a caretaker government. We could be in a sense, Alan, a little bit of a worse situation, which is we can be coasting for another 2 or 3 years of elections that are stalemated again, where we don't really do anything. And there can't be a real government policy, not legally in terms of the way our system works. So I think that in itself is a challenge. But I also think what I said previously is also a challenge. Hey, get a negotiated settlement now. The world needs to be involved now, because Israel has changed its way of looking at things. And it is, we're not going to let anyone rebuild. We're not going to let anyone become a threat. We will take care of that first. And that is not good for the peace of the world.
Francesca, I'm going to come to you in a minute, but I have to ask Hussein. You were a diplomat for a long time. What Abraham just described doesn't sound like the basis of much of a negotiation. How do you negotiate? How does Iran negotiate with Israel if Israel has now decided that it has to slay the dragon every time a dragon raises its head? And it has the capacity to do so. As you said, Abraham, unleashed.
See, Alan, there are some facts which we really cannot deny or neglect. One fact is what General Wellesley Clark, the former NATO commander, revealed in year 2000 that Pentagon has a plan to attack 7 countries. And by now, all 7 has been attacked. 6 of them before Iranian attack were already attacked, and Iran was the last one. I mean, this was not Iranian official or someone non-official. It was the former commander, American commander of NATO, say that it has been a plan by Pentagon to attack 7 countries. And therefore, using the WMD pretext to attack Israel or nuclear to attack Iran, I mean, if this is the case, if really this is the case and behind the scene, the decision already is taken, there is no use for diplomacy and negotiations. And the second fact, when we are talking about Israel, Abraham, I think you will agree with me that since 1947, 48, we have had about 400 UN resolutions, either by UN Assembly General or General Assembly or by United Nations Security Council, and Israel has violated overwhelming majority of them, especially about the two-state solution. If there is going to be a solution, it should be based on two-state solutions. This is for 78 years, overwhelming majority of international countries, over 190 countries, they are supporting two-state solution, but the U.S. and Israel are opposing. Therefore, is there going to be any solution on Palestinian-Israeli crisis after 8 years? It depends whether the U.S. or Israel would respect UN resolutions and the international laws and regulations and would accept a two-state. If there is going to only one state, then you can imagine the resistance would continue, whether Iran is supporting or not. We should not forget before revolution clashes between Israel and Palestinians with Fatah, Yasser Arafat was much more than with Hamas. In that time, Shah had a good relation with the Israel ambassador. The Israeli ambassador was in Tehran. I mean, the Shah was U.S. allies, but we had the same conflict even before revolution. Therefore, we need to see the requirements of diplomacy to be successful. For Iran and Israel, I think they both need to come to a conclusion that they need to respect the international laws and principles, not threatening the existence of each other, not interfering, respecting the integrity and sovereignty of each other. This is UN Charter. I mean, and both they have violated. It has not been Iran. Iran in the slogan has been more powerful than Israel, threatening the existence of Israel. But in practice, frankly speaking, Israelis, they have been more powerful to threaten the Iranian existence. And they do not talk, but they act. That's why we need to pay attention to the principles Iran, Israel, the U.S. or even the regional powers, international powers, they need to respect to come to a successful negotiation. And this is international laws, regulations, and UN Charter. As long as we have a country like the U.S. does not, or Israel does not respect UN resolutions, and unilaterally they decide to attack this country or that country, of course, they have to have some reasons and to discuss about different reasons. In Iraq, there is WMD. Iran is going to make nuclear bomb or Saddam. Even you remember Libya. I mean, when they negotiated with Gaddafi, when Gaddafi gave up every nuclear facilities or technology or equipment, then they attacked. Therefore, it really didn't matter whether Gaddafi had nuclear capability or not. I mean, I really don't know what is the bottom line of the U.S.
Francesca, the argument is just made that absent two-state solution, this conflict continues in some form or the other forever. Do you agree?
The two states, where a Palestinian state should be? Where? There is no West Bank anymore already now. Really, there is no West Bank. I mean, just walk around, drive around, and settlements are everywhere. And Gaza, well, look at the rubble of Gaza. So the point is not, you know, just two states or one state. It's the way you live. Regardless of how many states, you know, that's the point. I think, you know, it's not about one state, two states, three states, or even the 10 states, you know, that Israel is trying to set up probably in the West Bank now with these tribal leaders. So one state for every city. No, it's about, you know, it's about the leadership. I belong to the generation of the Arab Spring. So we have really a leadership issue everywhere. In Israel, of course, in Palestine, of course, in Iran, I would say, you know, because of course, you know, Iran calls Israel, you know, to respect international law, rightly so. But, you know, I was in Syria all the war. What about Iran and international law? What about Iran and Syrians, Iran, you know, and so I think it's a matter of leadership now, you know, and from new leaderships, you can have creative solutions also because, you know, I spend most of my time in Jenin. And in Jenin, you know, the young Palestinians in Jenin always say that somehow, you know, this is a war of the last century. This is a war, you know, for states, nation states, a war for flags, you know. Really, this is not a war of our generation. You know, our generation is used to travel and to have no borders, you know. Of course, you need to have a passport and you need to have, you know, a state to be able to travel. But, you know, we might think of different solutions, you know, think of the European Union, you know. I think that leaderships now come before, you know, this debate about one state, two states, or for now we have zero states, honestly.
And the clear question is still, what next? If we have Israel going into elections, so won't do anything. In Iran, Hossein, obviously there's going to be a transition at some point. The supreme leader is old and everyone waits for that transformation. You don't have elections for a while, but a far more important transition coming up. It would be really easy to come away from the conversation so far completely depressed. That is to say that there isn't a basis for Iran and Israel to figure out how to live together. At least that's what I've heard so far. So why am I wrong on that?
I'm going to start a little bit with the local before the global. And that is what Francesco was saying. I think that I think we've always been trapped here with, and we need vision. And what Francesco, I believe, is saying is, that where's the vision? Where is the young leadership to see things in a different way? Like her reference to the EU. If the world would take charge, and I don't mean that it's the responsibility of anyone except for us, except for we're not getting it done. Right now in Israel, the prevalent understanding of the world in the local is, hey, what do you want us to do? Look at what happened in Gaza. Look at that existential threat that happened in Gaza. And now what should we do with the West Bank? And I think that if we had better vision, rebuilding Gaza, coming in as a global community and saying, we're going to affect change in Gaza for the positive, for all of those poor people that are suffering, for the positive, over a X amount of year period, we could create something great and dynamic with a better future for the people in Gaza. And then the Israelis will turn around and say, hey, how could we not do that in the West Bank as well? Look how great it's worked in Gaza. Instead of being afraid of the West Bank because of what's happened in Gaza, I think that there's an opportunity right now, if the world will seize that opportunity, to create a better world for all of us. In terms of Iran, I think that that suits that position as well. I don't want to be pessimistic. What I think I was saying was that we are not going to allow danger to fester against us. But that doesn't mean that we, Israel, doesn't have the opportunity to say, wait a minute, if someone wants to reach out their hand, then we can reach out our hand back. And again, I think the problem for the Middle East really is that everyone reacts to what's going on as if they're the victim, as if they're afraid. And I think that everyone has a right to feel that way. But the question really is, can the global community come in and hold our hands respectfully, all of our hands, and say, hey, I understand why you're afraid. Let's walk forward together. Because Palestinians have every right to be afraid. And the Israelis have every right to be afraid. And as Hussein explained, the Iranians have every right to be afraid. Okay, how do you break that fear? No one's going to react positively from a position of fear. They have to react positively from a position of encouragement. Who in the world can sit down and say to all of us, I understand what you're saying, and I feel for you, Now let's move forward together. So I don't think that it's pessimistic. I think we just need to find that global leadership that has the ability to see that there's a better future for all of us.
Color me skeptical about global leadership being any better than, as Francesca describes, local leadership. And isn't that almost a cry for help? We can't solve our own problems, so couldn't someone come down and solve all this for us? I was saying, you've been arguing that the diplomatic channels have produced not what they should have produced. What would you do differently going forward?
As I said, Alan, I really don't know what is the criteria, whether it's criteria is international law regulations or the U.S.-Israel law regulations. I mean, if the criteria is about international law, when we are talking about NPT, Witkoff, Arachi, the first two, three rounds, they had three major agreements. One was for Iran to export all 400 kilograms of 60% enriched uranium. I mean, all the claims or fear was that Iran has 400 kilograms of 60% enriched uranium and they can make 10 nuclear bombs. And Iran accepted to export or to dilute. The second was about the level of enrichment. The question always has been why Iran needs 20% or 60%. Iran accepted to go to civilian enrichment below 5%. And the other concern was about Iran cooperation with the IAEA. Iran accepted to have the highest level of transparency and cooperation with the IAEA to remove every ambiguities of the IAEA, even to implement the additional protocols. Therefore, the three major concerns within the framework of NPT was agreed. And then Iran was attacked. I really don't believe Israel or the U.S. They respect non-proliferation treaty. They don't care. I mean, you can understand. You can see, they don't care about non-proliferation. That's why Israel, with at least 90 nuclear bombs, now is claiming that is fighting for non-proliferation in the Middle East. Israel is the only country in the Middle East with nuclear weapon. Is attacking Iran or Iraq and the other countries which they are a member of NPT and they don't have nuclear weapon. I mean, I as long as we don't agree on the principles and the criteria, we cannot find any solution.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.